All right, so Scott, maybe this pilot shouldn't have gone, and we can talk about that in a little bit, but the pilot did go, and we're stuck in the situation where he needs to get out of the ice and maybe on the ground. Given that those are the two things that you might want to do, why not take the best of both worlds here, continue south like you're going to do, but then also request the Yarnav 2-1 approach in Stevens Point, where you can use the TAA to get lower and fly the approach to get even lower if you need it. If it turns out that you don't need lower, the ice is coming off at 3,000, you can cancel the approach request and go on. Why just descend to 3,000 when you can also have the approach available to you?
Yeah, it's certainly another viable option here. I certainly won't discount that per se. Ultimately, it'll get you lower, which is one of the things you want to do. And if for some reason you're lower at that point in time, you're already kind of established on approach. And at that point in time, you can call it quits if for some reason the icing just doesn't stop at the 3,000 mark like you think it will. So there's no issue in being able to do that per se. I just looked at it as being, you're picking up ice, you're at 3,600, you are in the kind of the edge of that icing regime where you're still creating ice. Certainly without having to do a lot of turning around, a lot of extra workload, I'm all about trying to make things as simple as possible. So for me, as long as you can point me in the right direction and tell me when I can descend at that point, that's a very simple, direct procedure. I find that sometimes my mind tends to go to mush when things start happening. And for me, it's just a matter of point me in the right direction and I know I'm going to get out soon. So I guess for me, it's an option to go ahead and do that approach. And once you're lower and you know that ice is not creating, then that gives you the kind of the saving grace at that point in time. You can just continue on there. So it is definitely an option. I would say my option two.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Do the one thing, the one simple thing that you know ought to solve the problem. Keep it simple. And then if you need the approach, you can still ask for it later, right?
Yep, I agree.
All right, so I know we have some disagreement around the table this time. I want to start with Doug, who's taking the approach into central Wisconsin, the Yarnav 2-6.
My thoughts here are very similar to what you've mentioned, Ryan, and what Scott has accepted. Yes, there is the TAA that's 100 feet lower, but I would request direct ASAIR, which is initial approach with a hill put. I'd request direct ASAIR and 3,000. And as soon as she was cleared there, I dived down to 3,000. As soon as I was at 3,000 and saw that I was shedding ice, I'd do as you suggested and say, well, we're going to change that and just continue on to our destination. It's just that in getting that and requesting the 3,000, my feeling is I might get it faster.
Sure.
That's my only reason. And then the end result is still continuing on my way. It's just to get down to 3,000 as fast as I can.
And then we have a few people here who are going back to Wausau for the Yarnav 3-1. Tom Turner.
Well, one of my concerns about continuing to go forward is that we didn't expect to be picking up ice where we are right now. So we're not absolutely certain that our earlier expectation that there will not be ice at 3,000 feet closer to destination, right? We're not certain that that's still true either. I like the idea of going back to where we have a reasonable expectation that there won't be ice because we just left there. And although my first thought was also to, make a quick arrival into central Wisconsin, that's going to introduce a lot of briefing and setup and such to the cockpit. If I were the instrument instructor on this flight, even if I were just making this flight IFR myself, I stress briefing and preparing for a departure alternate. And in this case, the departure alternate would probably be to fly the approach back into Wausau. We just did that. We've practiced it once just recently. So between me and my student, we probably have all of the materials we need out in front of us to fly that approach. It gives us a lower altitude fairly soon. So in an altitude where we didn't expect ice because we have a better expectation there won't be ice because we didn't have it when we were just there. And it saves having to do a last minute prep and brief for an approach that we had probably not considered at all during the process of planning this flight.
Tom Haynes.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to back up Tom on that one, because the same thing, because of the familiarity and the fact that we've already flown the approach recently. We've just been there and we know the area and it's briefed. And so it just seems simpler to me to go back into this airport where we've just had success. We knew that, know there wasn't ice there just a little while ago. And so it seems like a pretty safe choice to me.
John.
Yeah, concurring with that. If you look at the total distance from the VOR to the segment between Huxus and Zedney, then to the runway, it's only 13 miles. And that segment from Huxus to Zedney is 3,600 descending to 3. So even assuming you could get a radar vector from center, they could put you on that segment halfway between them. You'd be descending to 3 as soon as you're established. And you're turning inbound and descending and you're done. And you know it's clear. It's probably the only downside to that approach as opposed to some of the others is there's no approach lights. That's why it's a 250-foot DA. There's only reels. And if your windshield's iced up or something like that. But, you know, that's another issue. At least you'd be descending, probably losing the ice.
Doug.
Well, what John said, you're descending and probably losing the ice, but you're going back into colder temperatures with slushy ice already on your wings. And my concern, turning around and going back into colder temperatures, that slushy ice might turn into a pretty messy bunch of mixed ice on that leading edge right now. And if we don't start losing, my concern is to get down as quickly as I can to hopefully get rid of that ice. And I'm just concerned in turning around and going back, it might freeze solid rather than being slushy.
Well, how would you navigate to that 2-6 approach into central Wisconsin?
I'd request direct us air and lower. That would be my request, direct us air or lower. And hopefully, understanding the MVA is there, I would get a clearance that cleared direct us air, cross us air at or above. And as soon as I hear cross us air at or above, I'm pulling the plug and diving. There's some hope involved, but
Scott.
Yeah, so what we're all missing, though, is that there's a nice thermal gradient from north to south here. So it's unlikely you're going to see it get colder going south. In fact, even at your 3,600, it may still be fairly warm enough that eventually, even in a couple miles, you may find that the temperatures warm up. And that's a pretty solid situation here. This is not
is that a pun, guess. Scott?
Say that again?
Is that a pun? Is it going to be a solid situation? We're not saying turn around, it will become a solid.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, if you turn around and go into colder air, which I know it's going to be colder to the north. Now, I'm, of course, the weather guy, so I know for a fact in this particular case, it's going to be warmer to the south, and the gradient is really pretty sharp given the weather situation of this. For this scenario,
this is what I agree with you. I don't really intend on flying that approach into central Wisconsin. I just want to get down. As soon as I'm down, I'm requesting direct on to my destination with that same kind of thought that you've just enunciated.
No, that's all right. I was just going to say our original evaluation of the weather told us that the temperature gradient would take care of us at our planned altitude. Now that that has not worked out, how do we know how accurate that temperature gradient really is at this point?
Yeah, so you know it because at this point you have analyzed the big picture, and that gradient is not going to go away. Now, what's happened in this situation is that you've delayed your departure, and that's kind of brought in the colder air from the north quicker than what you had originally anticipated. But that doesn't mean that the warmer air goes away to your south.
I was just going to say, yeah, but how far to the south? We don't know. Our things are further south than we thought they would be at this point. So we have to still take it on faith that, okay, well, right here, it's colder than we thought, but it's still going to get warmer it's going to get warmer further south, and it's not going to be colder than we thought down there as well. That's what I'm...
Right. But you just took off and you noticed as your climb, this is not like you're not going through the weather that you experienced. You noticed in the climb of where you started to accrete ice, or at least you should have. And at that point in time, you know, hey, I know that the freezing level is right there at 3,000 or maybe just slightly below. So ultimately, I know that gradient is still there. So you're the best pilot report in this situation because you experienced it.
This is also, it wasn't entirely unforecast. It was the low freezing levels were supposed to move south as the day went on. The problem was the chatty airport manager in Wausau, which as that being my home base, I can attest to that being a real thing. So, Doug.
Now, another thing that Scott didn't mention in his commentary, but I'm sure he was thinking of it, and he did mention it just now, and I'm certainly doing this, up here in New England, we're flying a nice 6 months of the year. One of the most important gauges that we have in the airplane is the outside air temperature gauge. And Scott certainly indicated that he was watching his oat as he climbed to see where the temperature actually was. You know, he talks about icing escapes. Well, the icing escape is certainly quite often the best thing is to go to the warmer air, which might be below us. The other option is to go to get out of visible moisture. But where do we know where that warmer air is? And if we're watching the oat, we will get to see it. So it's something that needs to be considered flying in these conditions all the time.
Scott and then Bruce.
Sure. So that's a great point, Doug. And the problem is that 172 probably has one of those meat thermometers in it, which is probably not very accurate at all. But what I would have noticed as the instructor or as a pilot is when that ice started to accrete on the airframe, or at least I should have been looking for that. And whatever temperature that was at the time, the problem is as soon as that immersion thermometer starts to accrete ice, weird things happen for that as well. You start to get evaporative cooling going on, even if it's wet. So it's really hard to trust that thermometer versus the actual temperature. But what you're doing is you're comparing that to essentially what's happening outside on your wings. And once you've decided or discovered when that is, you look at your altitude and go, okay, I started picking this up at 2,800 feet. And at that point in time, you know, further south, it's going to be warm enough, certainly by 2,800 feet, that you're going to get out of the ice.
Bruce.
My choice is kind of predicated on how much preparation I've done before this flight and how much I've refreshed the information after we got our delay with the chatty airport manager. But like Scott said, I'm loath to start maneuvering at this point. I can continue straight ahead. I like the weather. The METARs are better south than the others that I've seen here. There's much better visibility. I don't want to have to go miss. I've got a student on board. A lot depends on how much we've prepared for this flight. Like Tom Turner said, you know, it's a really good idea to brief your departure alternate, even though we don't require one in Part 91. But I'm still comfortable proceeding with all the information I had, especially if I've refreshed it and get down. Because even as Doug said, the real goal is not to shoot that approach. It's just to get a little bit lower. And I'm only going to be a couple minutes before I can get down. And, you know, even doing a 180 is going to take me at least a 1 minute turn, right?
This is a scenario I can relate to on several levels. One is that I fly out of Wausau, so I am the instructor in the scenario that knows all the options right away. The other is just as an instrument instructor flying in Wisconsin, you come out of a long winter, not getting to go in the clouds at all. You've got these students that don't have experience in the clouds. And then you see a day like this, where the freezing level is 6,000, and you think, all right, here we go. But I've canceled a lot of flights when the weather looks like this, because you look at the temperature profile, and it's like 2 degrees, 3 degrees Celsius all the way up. And yeah, no ice is forecast, but the way I see it, if the forecast is off by 2 or 3 degrees, you're in a lot of trouble. And so my question, first of all, to the non-meteorologists here is, do you fly on days like this in something like a 172? Not the weather as it is when we departed Wausau, but originally back in Wautoma, where it is above freezing all the way up to 6,000.
I just canceled a flight with a student a few days ago because the freezing level is going to be right at 3,000 feet, at least forecast, even though it didn't look like, in my experience, that was very likely. But this was an end-of-course IFR check, and I didn't want to go up there and fool around with that on top of everything else. So we canceled the flight.
Doug?
I will fly in this with the caveat that I've always looked, will there be a viable escape? And in this situation, looking at the forecast, it did look like it would be viable by descending as long as I was heading back to the south. One other thing that I'd like to mention, Scott said, and it sounds like this 172 was one of those old 172s that had the little placard that said you had to turn on pitot heat below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And yes, 10 degrees C is 50 degrees Fahrenheit. So Scott's brought it up 10 degrees of Fahrenheit. But me personally, visible moisture, pitot heat goes on. Has nothing to do with the temperature. That goes back to when the Malibu first came out and there were 6 fatal accidents. Every one eventually turned out to be attributed to the fact that the pilot had failed to turn on pitot heat. And we look at the new airplanes today, the newer airplanes, at the annunciator panel, there is an annunciator light that is lit all the time, amber, saying your pitot heat is not on. So it's something that I absolutely require. Visible moisture pitot heat's on, even if I'm in Tucson.
Well, so to Scott then, when you see a forecast like this, how reliable is it typically? Would you fly a 172 on a day like this?
There's a lot of exceptional cases that could pop up in these kind of situations. In this particular case, there was a very well-defined temperature gradient that was occurring. And that was, for the most part, evaluated on several different things, such as a SKU-T diagram, which uses very high-resolution information to produce that forecast. The only real gotcha is you have to be careful of how long it is since you've last looked at the weather. So I'll go, back to the same conversation we had, is that as long as it hasn't been all that long, more than an hour or two, I probably am still comfortable for departing in this kind of situation and being a little bit late, turning around, feeling comfortable, knowing very well that that freezing temperatures are going to move, or that freezing level is essentially going to be moving south with time. But if 5 or 6 or 7 hours go by, then all bets are off at that point. You really need to be checking weather over and over again. Personally, if it was me, I got delayed by the manager, by the airport manager, I would have been back on the internet trying to figure out what's going on, making sure everything's still stable, would have never left without having checked that.
So you, as a meteorologist, you're able to look at the big picture here and put some of this in context and say this is probably a reliable forecast. Is it enough for the typical pilot to say the freezing level's at 6,000, probably good to go?
Yeah, I mean, it's in this particular situation, I think the average pilot should be able to take a look at the information, the GRMets that are out there, the freezing level forecasts. Ultimately, you have to be careful about the time resolution of the data you're using. If you're using the old FB winds or whatever, that may not be a good enough resolution for you. But most of the applications that are out there now have pretty well, at least a higher resolution time and space for that information. So it's just as long as you know where the frontal systems lie and kind of how that freezing level changes over time, I don't think you're going to see a lot of surprises for situations like this.
Okay. So the other point that I relate to this on is, as an instrument instructor in Wisconsin, you'll have students that get to the end of their training and they have very little or no actual instrument time. And I'm curious, Doug, when you get someone that shows up to you for a check ride with zero actual instrument time, are you skeptical of that person being ready to be an instrument pilot? Or
funny you should ask. And this is, to me, a very difficult problem. Because there are many applicants who show up not only with no IMC time, but the only time they've been in the system talking to ATC is for that 250-mile long-distance cross-country. And to pour some salt in the wounds on that one, the fact of the matter is I'm starting to find that there are a lot of instrument instructors who fall in the same category. To me, it's deplorable. In fact, I've got a guy scheduled for a practical test next week. And I said, if it's IMC, I'm willing to test as long as you are, and there's no ice. And he's ready to do it because he's got the time and he's been flying in the system and he's been flying in the weather right up until 2 days ago when there was some icing out there with an instructor, obviously. So, yes, I'm very concerned in what I'm seeing in applicants coming to me for the instrument rating where they really have no experience. They've got no IMC experience. They've got no ATC experience. And yet if they fly and keep the needle centered and they can do a recovery from critical attitudes and answer all my questions in the oral, I cannot fail them.
Bruce.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Doug, we just hired a new instructor at our flight school who did all of his training and all of his experience in Phoenix, he's got 0.5 actual, and he's a double I. So we're going to be spending some time with him in Seattle, getting him before we send him off with instruments.
How could he fly in Seattle and only have 0.5 of IMC?
No, he trained in Phoenix.
Oh, okay.
So he just moved up
here.
So, but I'm definitely going to be spending some quality time with him before we turn him loose with instrument students. Fortunately, it's moving into the summer, so we won't have to do that right away.
So one more question here. Let's say you're you don't have the option of getting down to 3,000 with any of these. Say it's 3,600 no matter what, and you know you're in the ice there. At what point do you declare an emergency and descend to 3,000 anyway, knowing that there's nothing out there to hit? Is that a valid thing to do at some point, Scott?
So ultimately, what you're paying attention to, close attention to, are things like, you know, what kind of ice secretions are you getting? In the end, this is a slushy kind of ice. So if that's still what you're getting here in that particular case, you know, you're not in a situation where things are going to get really ugly very quickly. A lot of times that ice tends to slough off pretty fast. You know, you're in the warmer regimes of those sub-freezing temperatures. So yes, you don't want to stay in it too much longer. You don't want to be in it 10, 15 minutes or anything like that, but an extra couple of minutes, even if it's 5 minutes of time, you're probably not going to end up in a situation where that aircraft suddenly, but if you start playing around with the angle of attack, you know, there's a possibility at that point in time that the that stall speed creeps up, and as that airspeed drops, you know, weird things can happen, especially if it starts to get a little bit colder and starts to freeze. So I'm comfortable as I'm looking at the ice accretions itself. I would probably not declare an emergency unless those ice accretions start to become really solid. At that point in time, then I'm getting down as quickly as possible and I'll declare emergency.
It's interesting to me that we chose every answer here, really. And they're all valid. I mean, I think they all could work. I think the common thread to this is knowing what the options are and being able to pick one in a timely way that's going to work, whether it's the best one or not. If it works, it works. So that speaks to preparation. I mean, this pilot in this scenario knew the options because he flew there all the time, but you want to try to have some of that level of familiarity before any flight, especially a situation where you could find yourself in ice and you might need a quick out, because 2 minutes waiting for lower is going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be a lot more uncomfortable if it's 10 minutes while you study all the local approach charts.